This morning we talked a bit about what the resurrection actually accomplished. Not necessarily what it proved. I think it did prove some things, but it also did something in and of itself. It wasn't just proving something other than itself, like that Jesus is the Son of God, although certainly it's a great evidence of that. It actually did something that changed the world. It started the process of resurrection that we are waiting for the ultimate realization and the ultimate fulfillment of in our own resurrection. The imagery that Paul uses is that there's a harvest coming, and the first fruits of the resurrection harvest have already come, and that was through Jesus, and we're waiting for the rest of the harvest to be reaped, and that will be our resurrection. And so whatever Jesus' resurrection was, that's what our resurrection will be. And it has already started, yet it has not yet been fully completed. So we find ourselves living in the new age, but still waiting for the ultimate fulfillment and reality of the new age for ourselves. And so what Paul tells us to do as we're waiting is to consider yourselves as alive from the dead. He says, present yourselves to God as those who have been raised from the dead, and to your instruments as members of righteousness in view of that age to come. And so we live now as a resurrection people. And so I think it's a wonderful idea, and I think that's something that is profoundly true, and it's our mission, and it's part of our call, and it's part of what the kingdom is in and of itself. Yet, that only makes sense to do if, in fact, the resurrection did start with Jesus, if Jesus really did rise from the dead. We mentioned just briefly this morning that sometimes when people talk about the resurrection, it seems like the main thing they're wanting to do is apologetics. The resurrection becomes kind of this battlefield for the truth of Christianity. If you can prove the resurrection, Christianity's true, and if you cannot prove the resurrection, then it's false. I would say that's not actually the right way to think about it. I would say it is true, yes, if the resurrection happened, then Christianity's true, because Paul makes that argument. And Paul makes the argument if the resurrection did not happen, then Christianity is false. But that's different than saying if you can prove the resurrection is true, and if you cannot prove it, then it's false. Because there are a lot of things that may be true that we cannot prove, and there may be a lot of things that are false that we cannot prove. They're just beyond the scope of our available knowledge. And so our ability to prove something is not what makes it true or false. And so the resurrection, even if it is beyond historical proof, may still very well be true. And so an inability to prove something that happened, there are so many things that happened 2,000 years ago that we can't prove, we don't even know about, but it doesn't mean they didn't happen. The resurrection may very well be something that happened, even if it can't be proven. But what I want to do tonight is look at why there are really solid reasons to think that it did in fact happen. That even just as putting on, you know, your historical glass, your historian's glasses, and looking back at the events that took place, there is really good reason to actually believe, as a rational human being, that something completely unique in human history took place on that day and has changed the world from that point forward. And the best explanation of that radical, unique event is that Jesus rose from the dead. One of the ways we're going to do this is by asking, why in the world did people come to believe that in the first place? Like, not necessarily from my perspective, but from the perspective of a first century Jew who became a Christian. Why would a person do that? Why would a person do that when it was not part of Jewish theology or their belief system or their worldview that there was going to be a Messiah who came and was crucified and then rose from the dead? Like, it would make sense if that was already part of their religious expectation and already part of their theological undergirding, and that was their understanding of what was supposed to happen, and then you told them, hey, this happened. They would say, oh, it did? Amazing. You know, that might be something. But this is something that it doesn't support their theology. It actually destroys a lot of what their theology and expectation was. Why would someone be convinced that Jesus was risen from the dead? What would it take to do that? We're going to talk about that question a little bit. We're going to talk about why it is that all of a sudden a bunch of Jews who are staunchly monotheistic come to worship a human being as God. especially one that was crucified. Why would you do that? If there's any evidence in this, I mean, I think in the way that ancient people thought about crucifixion, if there's any evidence that a person is not God, it would be that they were crucified and humiliated and died on a Roman cross. If you're looking for like any, what's the number one thing to prove that someone is not God, that's probably the best thing you can come up with. They were humiliated, defeated by human beings, nailed to a cross, publicly mocked, and they died on there. All right, that's not what gods do. And so that is this profound, yet somehow the person that that happened to is the person who, they didn't give up faith in him. They didn't turn their back. They ended up becoming, for some reason, even more convinced of the reality of his kingdom and his message. And all of a sudden, it started growing like wildfire to believe that he is God and that he was raised from the dead. How does that happen? What in the world could have caused that transformation in people's thinking? Something happened, because that did happen. Like, people changed their way of thinking. Christianity began. It existed. It grew. It exists to this day. What could have happened that would have caused that, that makes any sense at all? Why is it that a bunch of Jews who were monotheistic start worshiping a human being as God? Why is it that a bunch of Jews who had honored the Sabbath begin gathering together on the first day of the week, on Sunday, and treating that as a holy day? And taking the Lord's Supper with one another and prioritizing worship and encouragement and using the Sunday for a day for gathering. What would have caused that? Why that transformation and why that switch? Something must have happened to cause that. It wasn't just reading the Bible. It wasn't just some new preacher who came along and said, I think we ought to do this. Something actually happened that caused a transformation in their practice of worship. What could that have been? Why is it that these early Christians, these early Jews, start, instead of saying, go to the temple to receive forgiveness of sins and offer sacrifice, they say, hey, if you dunk someone underwater like you're burying them, and then you pull them up out like they're being raised from the dead with Christ, that is where they'll find new life and forgiveness of sins. What would have caused that to come about? Again, that's not going to come just from reading the law of Moses. Something had to have happened that imitating a death and a resurrection became crucial to entering into this movement and entering into this kingdom. Like, resurrection became our entry point into the kingdom after Jesus. Why is that? What could have caused the imagery of death and resurrection? Well, I think you know the answer I'm going to give. I'm going to say because they came to believe in the resurrection of Jesus, and they saw that as the launching point for a whole new way of life. To where Sunday, the Lord's Day, becomes the key day for worship observance to God. Where baptism becomes this image of death and resurrection that we enter into. That preaching resurrection, even if it meant getting you mocked or even killed, became the central point of early Christian preaching. That a human being who was crucified began to be worshipped as God. The reason they started doing that is because there was this firm conviction that he was not dead. That he launched a new age through rising from the dead, and he defeated death. Now, here's the critical question. I don't think it's a question whether or not they believed that. They did believe that. In every early Christian document we have, that's the consistent belief. In fact, we have, and this is important historically speaking, we have no evidence at all of any Christianity existing without a belief in the resurrection, like in the first century. You do actually see much later on in some Gnostic documents, the idea of people, you know, wanting to be Christians and following Christ without belief in the resurrection. But isn't that interesting? You know how myths develop? It usually takes a little bit of time. The earliest we have is of belief in the resurrection, and it takes time to develop the idea of a Christianity developing without resurrection. That is something that you see in later documents. But our earliest documents, the earliest belief that we have in Christianity, is of a resurrection. Now, why is it that that would be the belief? It is important to know from the beginning that ancient people were not just foolish, gullible, ignorant, unscientific people who thought, people rose from the dead all the time. One thing that I think sometimes happens is when people start thinking about people a long time ago, I think C.S. Lewis uses the language of chronological snobbery. We could think, well, because we exist now, we know that dead people stay dead. But back then, those people, you know, they might not have been so convinced of that. So it'd be really easy to convince one of them of resurrection. It would not have been easy to convince one of them of resurrection. Resurrection, let me say this, death was sad, even for them, because they understood what death was. They experienced grief just like we do, because they knew that they weren't going to see their loved one next Tuesday if they just passed away. They understood that death was a permanent thing also. In fact, you could get mocked and ridiculed for even suggesting the idea of resurrection. And so, how are you going to get a bunch of people who don't believe in resurrection to all of a sudden change that whole way of thinking, change their whole religious outlook, change their whole view of God, and become this community that now is a resurrection people who are enacting the resurrection themselves through baptism? Like, how does that happen? Well, I'll tell you a couple ways I don't think it happens. Number one, and some of these I've already made reference to, I don't think it is confirmation bias. What I mean by that is sometimes if you believe something, I'm not going to get too specific here, but let's take politics, for example. A lot of times people who have a strong political belief, whatever happens in the government or in the world around them, they will view it through the sieve of that political belief so that it will end up just about always supporting their political belief, their political side, their political candidate, like no matter what happens. And if the other guy was in charge and the exact same thing happened, they would perceive that as a negative about that guy. It's like whatever you see, you can kind of interpret it to support whatever view you have, to where mine's the obviously right one and this is the obviously wrong one. That happens, I think politics is just one of the most obvious examples where that happens all the time. But it happens in all sorts of areas where when you're looking for something you already believe, you find it. And you find evidence of it everywhere. And it often supports, it confirms what you already know to be true. It's actually really hard to not have confirmation bias. I mean, we tend to have a bias towards the things that we think are true. That makes sense. You would expect that. And so if you think something's true, you're obviously going to see more evidence of that than evidence that it's false. Is that what's happening with the disciples? They are simply finding ways to confirm what they already believe to be true. And so no matter what happens, they're going to find, well, sure, Jesus was raised from the dead, because, you know, even if they don't have a lot of evidence for it, because that's been their belief all along. Well, actually, no, we've already said. This wouldn't be confirmation bias. This would be the exact opposite of that. This would be something happened to destroy what they believed rather than to confirm what they believed. Because early followers of Jesus were not raised looking for a Messiah who was going to rise from the dead. That was not the Jewish belief at the time. In fact, it surprised everyone and it disconfirmed their beliefs rather than confirming them. And so, you know, it might be easy to convince someone of the resurrection if they're already believing that it's true and just looking for it somewhere, and then you say, it happened. And they say, really? But if someone already does not believe that that's even possible, and that's not part of God's plan for the Messiah, and you start telling them, no, it happened, they're going to want more than that. They're going to want more evidence rather than less evidence. And so this isn't simply an easy belief for ancient peoples. This isn't simply confirmation bias, whether you are Jew or whether you are Greek. You did not believe in this. The Jewish leaders, the Sanhedrin, they didn't believe in any resurrection at all, even at the end of time. Like, the priests and the leaders of Israel at the time did not believe in resurrection. Certainly not for the Messiah, but they didn't even believe in it for other people. Greeks, they did not believe in resurrection. They believed in what you might call the immortality of the soul, which is the idea that your soul lives on after you die, and we need to be careful not to confuse that with the belief in resurrection. Those are not the same beliefs. Greeks believe in the immortality of the soul, but would mock the idea of the resurrection. That happens in Acts 17. I think sometimes in Christian thought, we've kind of combined those ideas to where we think that, well, resurrection is just your soul living on after you die. No, resurrection is your body actually rising from the tomb. That's what it means. You are rising up again. Jesus says that the tombs will be empty. Jesus' tomb was empty, not because his soul lived on after his body was in the tomb. His body came back. That's what resurrection is. And that is not a belief that Jews had about the Messiah. It's not the belief that the Jewish leaders like the Sadducees had even about the end of time. It's not the belief that Greeks had. So telling someone that the resurrection has happened confirms no bias. As a matter of fact, it disconfirms all of their beliefs, and they have to think, what are you saying now? This is a belief that would get you mocked, saying that the Messiah was crucified. Paul says that is a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to the Greeks. That's not an easy message to preach. That's a message that people are already, just at the mere onset, going to reject. You have to really provide something strong for them to come to believe it. Simply saying it happened wouldn't do it. And so it's not confirmation bias. Is it that they were just pre-scientific, gullible people, easy to trick and fool? Again, I would say no. You do not need to be a scientist to know that dead people stay dead. They knew about death. They mourned the loss of loved ones. They understood death just as well as we do. And so they were not seeing resurrections, you know, every time they turned the corner and like, oh, there's another one. This was not something that was common in ancient belief. This is something that was specifically rejected by most people and was something that, you don't have to be a scientist. By the way, if it was common, if the idea of resurrection for ancient simpleton folk, if it was just a common belief that a lot of them had, then it wouldn't have been unique and it wouldn't have started a whole religious, you would have needed something else. You need something that's uncommon in order to start a religious movement. If it's just like, oh, any of them can believe in a resurrection, then that means there's nothing special about what happened with Jesus. So what happened with Jesus was special enough to shake the foundation of people's beliefs. So that means it wasn't something that many of them just would have accepted easily. It had to have been hard to accept. So again, it's not confirmation bias. It's not just pre-scientific gullible folk. What about cognitive dissonance? We've all probably experienced cognitive dissonance before. You ever have a belief that you hold strongly to, and then you're confronted with reality that does not line up very well with that belief, and you have to try to figure out, well, what in the world? Is reality wrong or is my belief wrong? And usually what we'll choose is, somehow this isn't reality. There's some other way to view this to where my belief is still right. I've experienced this before while driving with Lauren. And she's telling me, no, the restaurant's over on that side. And I say, no, I've been here before. It's over on this side. And she says, it's on that side. And I turn and the restaurant's not there. And I'm confronted with this uncomfortable feeling that they must have moved the restaurant. That's cognitive dissonance. That is where it's like, you got to come up with some explanation to help you out here. The foundational work on cognitive dissonance, I think it was 1956, a book, When Prophecy Fails, by Leon Festinger. It's a fun book. A really interesting study took place where there was this doomsday UFO group that believed that the world was going to end. Marion Keech is the name given to the leader of that. I think that's a pseudonym that is given to her in the book. But she has this belief that the world is going to end, and her and the people who are a part of her movement will be rescued at midnight by a UFO and taken to go live on another planet. And so they have the date set of when this is supposed to happen. And there's actually a large group of people who have bought into this, not like a massive group, but a sizable group of people. And they have become so committed that they have quit their jobs. They are fully convinced that the world is going to end and that they are going to be rescued from it. Now, what Leon Festinger and his group of researchers did was they actually had some people infiltrate this group as believers and record what happens, and notice the title of the book, When Prophecy Fails. Note what happens when prophecy fails. When you have a prophecy that you're supposed to be saved at this time by this UFO, what happens when that goes wrong? Well, so they record the events of that night when it was supposed to happen. Everyone had gathered together in her house, and they were waiting for midnight when this was going to happen. And there was a lot of anxiety in the room. There was some singing that took place. But eventually, they start getting closer to midnight, and then it happens. Midnight comes, and nothing happened. And there was some silence. And after a minute or two, someone looked in the kitchen and saw that the clock in the kitchen was a couple minutes off. And they said, okay, it hasn't hit midnight yet. We got another try at this. And then it happened again. And nothing happened. And then it was like 12:15, then 12:30. And they sat there in silence, confusion, and disbelief for several hours. Eventually, some people started to leave. But then it happened. And this is the cognitive dissonance. This is the study. She received another prophecy. Guess what? That group was so faithful and so committed to their belief that God decided not to destroy the world. And so they came to believe, even more committed now, that they were the ones who saved the world. So when prophecy failed, they didn't have to give up on their belief. You just kind of adjust to the prophecy a little bit, and you come to realize, hey, because of our actions, the world has been saved. Now we go and we spread the message of salvation to the world around us. And that's kind of, it's an interesting study. But there is a point that is made that may very well be the explanation of the origins of Christianity. Jesus was supposed to be the Messiah. And they had their beliefs, and they were committed to these beliefs, and they truly were convinced that he was going to be the Messiah, and then he was crucified. Well, you got to come up with something to help explain, our Messiah isn't here anymore. Our Messiah has been killed. Our Messiah was defeated by the Romans. He didn't defeat the Romans. And all of a sudden, all of their hopes, and these people had quit their jobs, and they had been roaming around and suffering and committing themselves to him, and they come to find out that it's wrong. What are they going to do? Well, they have to come up with something. And so they come up with the idea of the resurrection. And the resurrection is what they go on and what they proclaim and what they teach. And that's kind of how they made sense of life after the crucifixion. What's the problem with that? Well, there's a bunch of problems with that. And we'll see some of them here in just a little bit. But one of those problems is that's not how you continue the message of Jesus after the crucifixion. What I mean is, if Jesus was crucified and there was no resurrection, right? The disciples would have maintained the beliefs that they had already had, and they would have said, okay, our Messiah might have died, but his kingdom and his message lives on through us. That is simply evidence of the darkness of the world and the need that we have for this message. And so we go out and we continue to proclaim this message. I mean, you can keep the ideals and the message of Jesus going without a resurrection. You can keep the idea of the kingdom without a resurrection. You go and you continue to preach as he has preached and as he's taught you and prepared you for. I mean, he's already said that he's going to be departing. So you go on and you say the Messiah has come and he has taught us how to be his kind of people. I mean, you can easily continue the message even without a resurrection. Or here's something you could do. Peter kind of seems like he was number two in that group. Maybe Peter becomes the new leader of the movement. Or what about James? Maybe James becomes the Messiah. James is the brother of Jesus, became a prominent leader in the church in Jerusalem. Josephus writes about James, the brother of the Messiah. Why doesn't he become the Messiah? Why don't you just find a new Messiah who continues on the group? We actually have, by the way, a good number of these messianic type movements in the early centuries during the Roman Empire, where one of the leaders got a little bit too well known and was crucified by the Romans. And do you know what tends to happen to those movements? They either fade away and die, or you find yourself a new leader, a new Messiah, a new anointed one to lead the group. What none of them did was say, oh, he must have been raised from the dead, and we've actually sat with him, and his tomb is actually empty, and we've eaten food with him, and then he ascended into heaven. That's not what you say. What you say is, he might have died in the flesh, but his spirit lives with us to this day. And when we gather and worship, we worship in honor, and we worship in the presence of his spirit. Like, you come up with some explanation, You don't invent the story that none of you believed in anyway, and that was never a part of your belief system, of a resurrection. So the whole cognitive dissonance trying to come up with an explanation, that doesn't work very well because it doesn't explain things like the empty tomb, which we'll talk about here in a second, and it wasn't part of the belief system of the group to begin with. That they were all confused about the idea of the resurrection. In fact, I just want to read two passages quickly from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 9. At the Transfiguration, Jesus goes up on the mountain. He's transfigured. Moses and Elijah appear with him. And as he's coming down from the mountain, notice this is Mark 9:9. As they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus gave the disciples that were there, Peter, James, and John, he gave them orders not to relate to anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man rose from the dead. And then it says, and they seized upon that statement, discussing with one another what rising from the dead meant. You know what that tells me? They were not people who had a good, solid understanding of what Jesus' plans were. They didn't even know what he was talking about when he talked about rising from the dead. In fact, later in the same chapter, Jesus says, verse 31, he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and when he has been killed, he will rise 3 days later. But they did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. You know what you're getting here? You're getting what we've already known about the Jewish worldview at the time, is they were not expecting their Messiah to rise from the dead. Why? Because they weren't expecting him to be crucified. If he was crucified and they wanted to continue the movement somehow, you come up with something that you already believe. You treat him the way that you've treated Moses and Elijah and other great prophets. You honor his tomb. You say that he lives with us in spirit. You have another prophecy, like remember about Elijah, that someone is going to return in the spirit and the power of Elijah. You say that he'll return again in the spirit and power of someone else. Like, you come up with something, but you don't immediately jump to resurrection, a belief that none of you would have had to begin with. So, for all these reasons, those aren't great explanations of what would have convinced them. But I tell you what I do think would have convinced them. A couple of things. One, an empty tomb. The place where Jesus was buried, the tomb where Jesus was laid, 3 days later, on the first day, when they went to that tomb, they found it empty. That's a profound historical reality if Jesus never was, never did rise from the dead. It's a key historical detail, and there's actually really strong support for it. One of the things that's really interesting about it is all four of the Gospels, they tell us who finds the empty tomb. You know who it is? It's a group of women. The exact numbers kind of vary from Gospel to Gospel. But in every one of them, the consistent detail is it was found by a group of women. You know why that's an important detail? I'm not trying to be sexist here. This is not my view. This is a view in antiquity. We have some writings from even Josephus that talks about the fact that when you are in a Jewish court and you know you're supposed to have like two or three witnesses, they can't be women. Because women, because of their gender, they're kind of hysterical sometimes, not overly trustworthy, easily duped, they're gullible. Again, not my view. But here's the point. The idea was there was some misogyny, there was some prejudice against whether or not women could be trustworthy witnesses to verify certain details. So if that's the case, and you are whole cloth inventing a story to try to convince a bunch of people about the resurrection, would you say that the empty tomb was discovered by the least credible witnesses? Or would you just skip that and say it was found by the most credible witnesses? Say that it was the Roman guards who discovered it. Say that it was the male disciples who discovered it. Something. You don't say that it was a group of women who discovered it. By the way, even in the Gospel of Luke, you see this idea a little bit when the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, when they are discussing with Jesus about what has happened, they say that some women have come along. Let me see this. This is Luke chapter 24 and verse 22. It says, but also some women among us, they amaze us. When they were at the tomb early this morning, they did not find the body. They came saying that they had seen visions of angels saying that he was alive. And And it says, then some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it exactly as the women had also said, but him they did not see. You have the idea of like, these women came, and that word amazed could be translated a couple of ways, but it's like, these women perplexed us with these things that they were saying, but then some of the men went there and they verified, hey, it was actually as they were saying. But the point is, if you're making up the story, you wouldn't leave such a crucial piece of evidence into the hands of a witness that would not be considered trustworthy. If I were trying to convince you of something and I were just making up a witness to support me, I wouldn't choose like a drug addict from the street or something. I would choose someone who is, you know, respectable, and you would respect their opinion. And that's why, it's one reason why you can tell that these stories are not, they're not the invention of someone trying to prove a point. They're just the record of someone telling you what happened. Let me give you another example of that. Look with me at 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. This is a couple years later. Paul is giving an early Christian creed or an early Christian testimony that has been recorded and passed down to him about the resurrection and about the early appearances of it. I want you to notice something interesting about it. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 3. It's a tradition that he's received from others and that he's delivering. So it's something that existed before he even wrote this book. But he says, "For I delivered to you of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he was seen by Cephas and the 12. After that, he appeared to over 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now, though some have fallen asleep. And he also appeared to James and all the apostles. And last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared to me also." All right, that's a powerful description of the resurrection of Jesus and the appearances to a lot of people he mentioned. He mentions over 500. But do you notice something they all have in common? They're all male. He says he appeared to Cephas and to the 12, the 500 brethren. Maybe there are some women in that, but he doesn't mention any women by name. He certainly doesn't mention Mary and Martha and like the women at the tomb. He doesn't mention Mary Magdalene or any of that. Why would he not mention them? Well, because this tradition is passed on, I think, for an apologetic purpose. It is a tradition trying to convince people of the reality of it. And so you wouldn't include details that are unhelpful, right? But in the early just recording of what happened, they actually mentioned the women by name. So again, what you can see is the reason that it mentions the women is not because it helps prove the case. It's because it's what actually happened. And that is what the early Christians recorded in the Gospels. It's also the case that he was buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. That's something that the Gospels tell us. And again, that's a detail unlikely to be made up. He was a member of the Sanhedrin that actually put Jesus to death. This is someone who early Christians, if they're just making stuff up, they're not going to choose one of the enemies to say that he's actually the one that they buried his body in the tomb. And you also wouldn't want to choose a well-known or prominent figure because you're just going to open investigation of that tomb. That's one thing you don't want. Because if you say a tomb is empty and you tell people whose tomb it is and that tomb is not empty, you've really dug yourself into a hole because it's going to be super easy to prove that the tomb is not empty. If people wanted to show that there was still a body in the tomb, you know what they could have done? Just go to the tomb and show that there's a body in the tomb. You get a couple of fellas, you move the rock away, and you show, hey, you're wrong, Christianity's over, body right there. But that's not what the disciples, what any of the enemies of Jesus did. In fact, you know what they said? They said the disciples must have stolen the body. Think about that for a second. What is that admitting? That's admitting that the tomb is empty. Even the enemies of Christianity, our earliest records, admit that the tomb was empty. And so one thing that I think would be convincing is that the tomb was empty. And again, there are good reasons to think it was. Even in Acts chapter 2, when Peter is preaching, he quotes from Psalm 16, which talks about God saying, "And I will not allow my Holy One to undergo decay." And people would have traditionally applied that to David, right? But then he says, look, David's tomb is still with us to this day. And guess what? His body's undergone decay. His tomb is right there. You can check it out. The implication is that this is talking about someone else whose tomb is not full with a decaying and rotting body. Even in Acts 2, he's using the empty tomb of Jesus as evidence that that psalm is not about David, it's about the other Holy One who will not undergo decay, one who comes from the line of David much longer after him, which is Jesus himself. So the empty tomb was actually a crucial part of the early Christian witness to the reality of the resurrection. But an empty tomb by itself doesn't actually completely confirm the resurrection. The absence of a body, you know, doesn't prove that someone was raised from the dead. If you went and you found, if there was some terrible accident and you went there and you couldn't find any of the bodies that were there, you wouldn't immediately think, oh, they must have all been raised. You know, you think, well, something must have happened. You know, I don't know exactly what. But an empty tomb, while it is a strong piece of evidence that something bizarre has happened, doesn't prove it in and of itself. But there's another piece of evidence also, and this is the many and varied appearances of Jesus to a wide range of people, even groups of people. We just read a list of them from Acts chapter 15. When you read the Gospels, you also see that the women were the first people to see the resurrected Jesus. In the Gospel of John, it's Mary Magdalene, the first to see the resurrected Jesus. And she goes and tells the other disciples. That's why she ends up getting the moniker in Christian tradition, the apostle to the apostles. Because she's the one who first proclaimed the resurrection from the dead. And she proclaimed it to the apostles. And then the apostles went and ran there to see what she had said. And so you have Mary, you have the other women, you have the disciples, you have this list of over 500. And one thing that's interesting in 1 Corinthians 15, when it says, over 500 brethren, most of whom remain until now, though some have fallen asleep. Paul's actually inviting, by the phrase saying, most of them are still alive, people to investigate this stuff. Like, you can go and talk to people who actually saw and witnessed the resurrection of Jesus. Now, again, you could say, well, it's just confirmation bias. Maybe they were so hoping to see the resurrected Jesus, which, again, they wouldn't have been because that's not really what their belief system was. But let's just say it was they were so convinced that they would, that they were alone late one night and they heard a sound and they turned and they saw something fuzzy for a minute and then it went away and they thought, oh, it must have been Jesus. You know, you could have little things like that. Our mind plays tricks on every one of us. Or there's some who say, like, hallucinations. This is actually a pretty common theory. Maybe they just so diligently wanted to see him that they hallucinated seeing him. There's a couple of problems with that. One of them is that the number of hallucinations, the fact that they did have language for hallucination, they could have said it was a hallucination. That probably would have been the more likely thing that they would have said if it was a hallucination rather than that he actually was raised from the dead. The fact that it happened to multiple people, the fact that it happened to groups of people, if you and I go to bed one night and then wake up the next day and we go out to have some coffee and I say, hey, how was that dream we had last night? You would think that was a strange thing for me to say because people don't usually share dreams. Those are individual things. Hallucinations usually work the same way where we don't just share hallucinations with one another, but that would be something that, so there's all of those things. But then also the fact that in this list in 1 Corinthians 15, you have two kind of interesting names on it. One of them is James, and the other one is Paul. And you know what they have in common? Neither of them were believers in Jesus until they saw the resurrected Jesus. James, the brother of Jesus, did not believe in Jesus during Jesus' earthly ministry. Yet after the resurrection, after seeing the resurrected Lord Jesus, he became one of the great leaders in the early church. Right? He wasn't someone who was going to bed at night hoping and longing to see Jesus somewhere, believing and expecting the resurrection. No, he didn't believe. He read John chapter 7. It says his brother specifically did not believe in him. Paul, he had that radical experience on the road to Damascus where he was breathing threats against Christianity. He certainly wasn't hoping and longing to see the resurrected Jesus and likely to see him around any corner. His whole world was radically transformed for the worse in many ways because of his experience of the resurrected Jesus. And his experience caused him to become a prisoner, caused him to lose the respect of his countrymen, caused him to lose financial opportunities, cost him his entire life. But why did he remain committed to it? It wasn't because of some benefit. It wasn't because of confirmation bias. It wasn't because he was old and gullible. It's because he saw what he saw, and he was remained committed to it, even to the point of death. So what is it that would convince the early Christians? The empty tomb of Jesus? The numerous and varied appearances of Jesus to a wide range of people convinced many people that this one who had already had a wide range of rumors circulating about him, that he's the one who had fed the 5,000, and that he's the one who had walked on the water, and he's the one who had stilled the storms, and he's the one who turned the water into wine, and he's the one who did all of these things, raised Lazarus. He had already proven in many ways that he was someone to be listened to and respected as a great prophet. Then, after the gruesome crucifixion, when you have his tomb found empty, and you have hundreds of people over a 40-day period of time having conversations with him, eating with him, seeing him, walking down the road with him, entering into rooms with all these different experiences, and then a large group of people seeing him ascend into the heavens, you're going to have strong reason to believe that this actually was true. Not because you were expecting it. I think that's the struggle of early Christianity. It hit them out of nowhere. It's the exact opposite of what they were expecting of a Messiah. They were expecting a Messiah to be someone who whipped the Romans into submission and gave, like King David defeating the Philistines, you know? Many of them, at least, were having that expectation. They certainly weren't expecting the Messiah to be impoverished, to be a preacher who traveled around, gathering a small following until eventually the Romans put an end to it and crucify him publicly to shame. But then, 3 days later, out of the power of God, was raised from the dead. That just wasn't the story that the Jews were expecting for their Messiah. But that's the story they went on to tell. Why would they tell such a story? Why would they believe it? Why would they practice baptism? Why would they begin to worship him as God? Why would they begin worshiping on Sunday? It's because it happened. And that is the best explanation. Something really strange happened back then. And if you're trying to figure out what it was, I don't think you're going to find a better one than what the earliest witnesses said happened, which is that he was raised from the dead. And that means something. It means something for every one of us, and it means something for the whole world. And it means something now, and it means something on into eternity, that we can have hope that death is not the final say, and that death is not the end of the story, but that there is life, and that God is the God of life, and that resurrection is our hope, and we should live our lives now in conformity with that hope. I want to close by reading one verse after Paul gives a rather lengthy description of what the resurrection will be like. He ends with these words in 1 Corinthians 15, "But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, and always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord." Because of the resurrection, the things that you do now, they matter. They are not in vain, and they are things that will matter now and on and into eternity. So, thanks be to God who gives us the victory over death. Thanks be to God who makes the kingdom work that we do now matter for eternity. So be steadfast, be immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. You were created for good works. You were created for action. Live in them, and I think God can do incredible things with that. If there's anyone here tonight who would like to become a Christian, would like to be baptized, be buried with Christ, and raised up with Christ to live for him from this point forward in newness of life, please let that be known and come sit on the front row while we stand and as we sing.